From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll meet a member of a Syrian refugee family and one of the locals who helped him and his family settle here in Milwaukee.
Then, as our coverage leading up to Earth Day continues, we catch up with a scientist working to understand Lake Michigan's changed food web.
Our wine contributor Ray Pfister stops by to sing the praises of a wine he says many of us dismiss.
The thing about rosés versus this idea of old world and new world wines is it changes the playing field. They just are really great just about everywhere. It seems to be a wine that it's hard to screw up.
And In Tandem Theater turns its entire space into a midway and big top to present the 1961 musical, Carnival.
It's got a little darkness to it. It's got some really beautiful moments to it. It's got some funny, typical musical comedy kind of moments to it. But then it's got some real heart and real depth.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. At last count, the civil war in Syria has displaced more than 5 million people. Most have fled to neighboring countries like Egypt and Turkey, while others have made their way to European nations in an effort to escape the escalating violence in their home country.
Here in the U.S., the Trump administration has tried to ban Syrian refugees from entering the country. So far, those efforts have failed, and people from the beleaguered nation have continued to resettle in the U.S., like the Hamdoun family, who emigrated to Milwaukee this past September.
The Hamdouns are a family of 13. They started the process of applying for asylum in 2014. Around that same time, a group of alumni from Milwaukee's Holy Angels Academy decided they wanted to help refugees resettle in Wisconsin. The alums reached out to Catholic Charities, and now more than 2 years later, the group is helping the Hamdouns make their way in America.
Anne Catalane is one of the volunteers and a Holy Angels alum. She joins me in studio along with Hussein Hamdoun, who at just 16 is the oldest child in the family. Thank you both so much for coming in to speak with me.
Thank you for having us. Yes.
And how did you get involved with this whole effort?
Our story starts when the Hamdoun family arrives in Milwaukee. They came from Turkey through the auspices of the State Department, and then they came into the States and were assigned to Catholic Charities. And my group of Holy Angels graduates from the class of 1962 had been working with Catholic Charities for almost a year and a half because we had the idea to adopt, and I say that in quotes, a family from Syria, because Catholic Charities did all the hard work and we did, well, the fun work and helped to organize and all those types of things. But we didn't actually meet the family until the night they arrived at the airport at Mitchell Field.
Hussein, where were you living in Syria and why did your family choose to leave?
We live in Syria in city is named Idlib. We like it live in Idlib because we have a relationship there.
You had relationships?
Yes.
Do you still have family in Idlib?
Yes, I have a family. Everything is there, my family.
Was it hard for you to leave?
No.
Why is that?
Because this is my country and my city.
So going to Turkey, what was that experience like for you?
We go to Turkey in 2014, but we go to Turkey, it is very hard to go to Turkey. We come in a bus, it's 15 hours.
Huh. Was it hard? Was it
yes,
a hard
too much
trip?
Hard, yes.
Too much hard, yeah.
What had you heard about the United States before you came here?
I listen here is America very good, and I can learn here more in Syria. I like here United States because I and my brothers one day be doctor, teacher. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did you think when you got off the plane and suddenly you're in Milwaukee, which I am sure is very different than Turkey, very different from Syria.
I like to come in a plane because before I don't come in a plane to bless any place.
Oh.
It was the family's first experience for all the family on an airplane. So they were very excited.
Well, I'm sure. And there's 13 of you, right?
Yes.
When you got off in Milwaukee, what did you think when you looked around? Was it snowing at the time?
No.
No.
Oh,
it's
good.
Rain.
Raining, yeah. The Holy Angels girls were at the airport. I brought some flags that I put out in my yard on the 4th of July. The last minute, I just thought I was going out the door, and I grabbed a big bunch of flags. And so we all stood there waving these flags and crying. We were all crying. It was such an emotional moment. Makes me cry right now. Because for 1 year and a half, we'd been waiting and waiting and waiting for them. And finally, here they were. And there's so many little children, you know. There was a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful moment. We were very excited. And they must have been just totally exhausted. So tired. Were you tired when you got to Milwaukee?
Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh.
What has it been like trying to kind of assimilate, I mean, and learning English? How has that been?
I learned from my school, and I learned English more in every day.
How are the little kids doing? You have so many younger siblings. How are they all sort of fitting in?
The little kids do well. The two who stay at home really don't speak English. Well, they're only 2 and 3. But the other children are learning, just like Hussein, every single day, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. But it's been slow progress. But we manage with sign language. Sometimes we translate things on our phone and show them what it is. Or we ask Hussein to tell his mom this, or ask Hussein, please ask your dad that, and because he speaks the best English in the family.
Yeah, yes, she's right. Mm-hmm.
He's a very good student too. He loves school and
thank you.
He's very smart, and he works too. He has a job.
Oh wow!
Yes. Here in Milwaukee Public Market.
Do you feel like you're getting kind of a hang of what the American schools are like?
Yes, I like it, the American school, because teacher is in school is a teacher very, very good, and they help we to learn English more.
Teachers love Hussein. Yeah. Actually, all the children, the mom and a translator and two of our group, our Holy Angels group, are retired teachers. And so they all went to the parent-teacher conferences together. And in particular, Hussein is doing very, very well. But all the children are doing well, considering what they've been through. And to just be dumped in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after you lived in Syria and Turkey for those years, and your first plane ride, and they got here and there wasn't a house for them because they're such a big family, and they had to have a minimum of 4 bedrooms. I think that's the state of Wisconsin that dictates that. So Catholic Charities had a hard time finding a house for them. But their teachers all gave excellent reports on the kids.
Do you feel like Catholic Charities has done a lot to try to help the kids kind of navigate their way through what can be a very complicated sort of education system, mm-hmm. especially when there are so many children mm-hmm. in a new environment?
Right. Catholic Charities does an excellent job. Catholic Charities is swamped right now. They have a lot to do with clients from Syria and from Somalia and from many different countries. And I'm not trying to pat our backs, the Holy Angels girls, but I don't know how they would have done this without us. We drive the mom and the dad to English lessons. When they're tutored at home, we come and take the children upstairs and play with the children or read with the children or do puzzles so the parents can study English. Everybody in this family really wants to learn. You know, they really want to learn. The mom, I don't think the mom has ever missed a class. That's one of my jobs that I do. I drive them to school. And I don't think she's ever missed a class. She goes every single opportunity. Of course, she might just like to get out of the house with 11 children, too. I hadn't thought about that till just now. But they are really dedicated to, you know, assimilating themselves as to the best of their ability.
There's a wider conversation that we're dealing with right now in the United States with specifically people in the government who are against allowing more Syrian refugees into our country. And what would you say? I mean, you've gotten to know the Hamdoudan family now, and you seem to spend a lot of time with them. What would you say to people like President Trump, yes, and Vice President Pence, both of whom have shown a lot of hesitation toward allowing more refugees in?
I don't think I could say over the radio what I would say to President Trump or Vice President Pence, but it's all about humanity and people helping people. That's how almost everybody in the world is in a position right now, because somewhere along the line, someone helped them. And we feel, my Holy Angels girlfriends feel, just privileged to be doing this for our country, for Catholic Charities, for DSHA, for the Hamdoun family, for the world. And I'm not Saint Anne, but if everybody felt the way we do, instead of the way Trump and Pence feel, wouldn't we be so much better off? You can hear Hussein when he talks. He has a quest to get out there and learn as much as he can and to go to school. And he wants to be a doctor. He wants to help people. And he's only 16 years old.
Well, thank you both so much for coming in and speaking with me today and sharing your stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hussein Hamdoun is a recent refugee from Syria. He moved to Milwaukee with his family. Ann Catalane is a member of Milwaukee's Holy Angels Academy, class of 1962. She and a group of classmates have been volunteering with Catholic Charities to help the Hamdoun family settle into their new home. For more information, head over to WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we're continuing our Earth Week series when we catch up with a scientist who is working to figure out Lake Michigan's changed food web. That's coming up next on Lake Effect.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. As we hit the midpoint of our Earth Week 2017 series, we look at some of the issues facing the Great Lakes. Reduced research funding is at the top of the list as President Trump's budget calls for the elimination of a 50-year-old program called Sea Grant.
Harvey Bootsma says that grant has fueled important research not only in his lab, but in that of fellow scientists at UWM's School of Freshwater Sciences.
The limnologist shares some thoughts with Lake Effect Susan Bentz. Starting with Sea Grant funded research on Lake Michigan he stepped into over a decade ago.
At that time we had a problem in Lake Michigan, which we still do, which is nuisance algae, too much algae growing in the nearshore zone. And the question was, why do we have that problem? It was a problem back in the 60s and 70s, and then we knew it was because too much phosphorus was going into Lake Michigan, which is a fertilizer for algae in the lake. But that problem was addressed by improving wastewater treatment plants, removing phosphorus from detergents, and to some degree improving agricultural methods to reduce phosphorus loading to Lake Michigan. So we thought we had that problem licked, and then this algae came back to haunt us again in the 1990s. And the question was, why is it coming back? So that's what we started doing research on with Sea Grant support. After a few years, we learned the reason for that problem.
The invasion of quagga and zebra mussels.
They were doing two things to Lake Michigan. They were clearing up the lake because they're filter feeders, so they eat the plankton in the water, and that clears up the water. So that allowed more light to get to the bottom of the lake in the nearshore zone, which is where this algae grows. So the algae was getting more light, and then the algae lives right next to the mussels on hard substrate, on rocks.
Plankton in a balanced ecosystem keep the food web happy. The littlest guys, phytoplankton, are consumed by very small animals called zooplankton, which in turn are food to fish. But the mussel invasion has turned that balance upside down.
When the mussels eat the plankton, they recycle the nutrients in that plankton, and they excrete those nutrients in a form that's usable for the algae. So because the algae lives right next to the mussels, they had first shot at those nutrients that the mussels.
So it's sort of like concentrated fertilizer?
Exactly, yeah, they were fertilizing. You had mussel manure, essentially, that was being made available to the algae. So it was a double whammy. The mussels were providing more light to the algae, and they were allowing more nutrients to get to the algae. So that was really what the problem was. And that was challenging, and it still is challenging, because now it's not a simple solution of just reducing phosphorus inputs to Lake Michigan to solve that issue. It's something internal within the lake that has caused the problem. That made us realize how much these invasive mussels were affecting Lake Michigan. So that moved on into more research into looking at how the mussels were changing things like the food web in Lake Michigan. So then with further Sea Grant support, we started looking at the nearshore food web to see how it was changing over time. And we learned a lot about what both the mussels and other invasive species like the round goby were doing to the food web in Lake Michigan. And that related to other research that we're doing in northern Lake Michigan, thousands of birds dying, being poisoned by botulism. And ultimately, it looks like this nuisance algae and the mussels are playing a role in that as well. What we're doing now is building on the research that we've been doing for the last 10 to 15 years, now trying to put it all together to look at Lake Michigan from a whole ecosystem perspective to say, how does the lake work right now?
Bootsman and his team are scrambling to figure that out.
We have all these mussels now covering the bottom of Lake Michigan, and we need to know how fast do they eat? How much plankton are they eating? That depends in part on the mussels themselves, on their biology, but it also depends on things like physics in the lake, because you have mixing in the lake that is essentially the mechanism that delivers the plankton to the mussels at the bottom of the lake. If the lake is mixing fast, then there's this constant delivery of plankton to the mussels and they can eat more. If mixing is slow, then mussels may not be able to have much of an impact on the plankton community because that food is not being delivered to them. So we need to understand the physics of the lake, and that's what we're trying to do with this work right now as well. We also need to know, what do the mussels do with that food that they eat? How much of that is recycled and made available again as dissolved phosphorus for plankton and other algae in the water? The other thing that we're doing, which is what Katie is involved in, is trying to determine right now, what is plankton production in Lake Michigan? We don't really know. We know that it's changed since the mussels have come into the lake. We know it's lower than it used to be, but we don't have a really good measure of how much plankton growth there is and how it varies with space and with time. Quite a bit of the research in the past was done in the southern part of the lake here. Very little research done in the northern part of the lake, so we're trying to cover the whole lake. So what Katie is doing is experiments to actually measure the growth rate of plankton.
That's graduate student Katie Bockwold. She recently joined Bootsma's team. This spring, she'll be analyzing samples gathered from spots around Lake Michigan. She's also tasked with figuring out the rate at which zooplankton reproduce. That can be a tricky endeavor.
Some species of zooplankton carry eggs in two sacks, some carry them in one. They're oftentimes really hard to count because you have to turn the zooplankton over in strange ways, and sometimes the eggs fall off, and it can be a mess sometimes. And then you use that along with basic population growth equations to calculate how many new individuals are being added to the population per unit time. So we'll go out, say, May 1st, we'll get samples, we'll count the eggs and biomass in that sample, and then 10 days later, on May 11th, we'll do that again and see how many new individuals have been added to the population based on calculating the difference between eggs and biomass between the two time periods.
Bootsma says without outside funding, such as Sea Grant, scientists would be hard-pressed to keep up with the challenges facing the Great Lakes.
You know, the best way to do research is to build on what you've done previously. And that's what's been great with Sea Grant support. It's allowed us to look at these initial individual-focused questions, but as we've worked on those, we've discovered, you know, for example, I talked about how we discovered invasive species were responsible for the nuisance algae growth. So that meant we needed to understand better what the invasive species were doing to Lake Michigan. So we've been able to build on that research over time to the point now where we're not looking at individual species or individual issues, but we're looking at the ecosystem as a whole. And basically we're at the point now where we're putting all the parts together to understand how the new ecosystem works. There's not many sources of funding for research that will allow you to build on your research over time like that, over a 10 or 15 year period, to get to the point where we are now.
The National Science Foundation became interested and is pushing BUTSMA's work forward.
The rules are changing for Lake Michigan and much of the Great Lakes. And in a way, we have a natural experiment going on here. It's not one that we would design or implement ourselves intentionally, but it is a big experiment that's going on because these new species have been introduced to the lake. And so that, in some ways, provides us opportunities to better understand fundamentally how lakes work. For example, in this case, does a lake work completely differently when you have a whole bunch of filter feeders on the bottom of that lake compared to a lake without those filter feeders? And that's a fundamental science question which agencies like the National Science Foundation is interested in, because those questions are relevant not just to Lake Michigan but to lakes in general. And so they've become interested in the work that we're doing, and they're also supporting a lot of our research now.
BUTSMA's thoughts turn to Earth Day. 47 years ago, its founder, Gaylord Nelson, wanted to heighten public awareness of threats to our air, land, and water. BUTSMA believes complacency is not an option.
There's a phenomenon in ecology called shifting baselines. And what that means is every generation kind of accepts the system for how it looked as they grew up. And they don't realize how different it is from what it looked like during the previous generation. And that leads to kind of a societal numbness where we accept the system the way it is, not realizing what it used to be or what it could be. I think about that a lot when I work on the Great Lakes and look at the Great Lakes, is how much they've changed and how much they're still changing, and yet generally how unaware the public is of that, partly because lakes are more difficult to understand. I wish I could take everybody below the surface of the lake so they could really see what's happening in the lake and how much it's changed. And the other thing I think about is how we look at natural resource management. We often look at things in an economic perspective. You know, what bang do we get for our buck? Our typical perspective is, if I invest in something, then I want to see a product from that. In the case of natural resources like the Great Lakes, we already have that product. We got it, and it's easy to think that we got it for free. It's amazing the resources that we get from Lake Michigan. The drinking water, the fisheries, the sport fisheries, the commercial fisheries. It's a resource for water intake for a lot of our plants. The aesthetic value, which is hard to put a dollar number on. We think of all that, and those are all products that we're already enjoying, and we tend to think that they're for free, but they're not. We're using that system, and by using it, we're changing how that system looks and how it works. We need to invest in that system, both to pay for the products that we've gotten out of it until now, but also to ensure that those products and that the system is continuously available for us and the generations that come after us.
Limnologist Harvey BUTSMA is an associate professor with UWM School of Freshwater Sciences. He and graduate student Katie Bockwold spoke with Susan Benz, and you can find out more about their research and hear all of our Earth Week segments at WUWM.com.
Wine aficionado Ray Pfister stops by after the break to recommend some good warm weather wines. Stick around, Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Every so often, when he isn't off in California trying out this year's vintage, Ray Pfister stops in to chat with us about wine. Well, we managed to catch him just as he was about to head west again, and he had rosé on his mind.
I think people think of it as a summer wine, a warm temperature wine. For me, rosé is year-round, but for anybody just kind of getting new into it, rosé tends to be, yeah, spring right on through fall, because you have it cold and people want something colder. Sometimes red wines, especially in the heat of summer, are a little tougher going down. Even at a lot of wine events, they'll generally focus more on whites and rosés than they will on reds if it's a big outdoor tasting in warm weather.
Now, they get a bad rap of being just kind of sweet and icky and not really white, not really red, you know, all of that stuff. But I have had some amazing rosés all the way from the most dry to very sweet, in between, some with effervescence, some completely flat. It seems like rosé can be just about anything else any other wine can be.
That's the difference between any other wine, is that a Cabernet is a Cabernet is a Cabernet. Of course, unless it's a blend or has other, obviously, varietals in it. Rosé can be anything. Rosé can be made from Grenache. It can be made from Cabernet. It can be made very, very commonly from Pinot Noir. You can make rosé from any kind of these wines. And I prefer a drier one myself. Sure, there are plenty of sweeter ones, but people see it and confuse it with the great 1980s boom of White Zinfandel, which it's not White Zinfandel. It's a completely different concept. But while some of us might turn our noses up to White Zin, if it weren't for White Zin, you know, that really helped create the wine boom of what we're experiencing now.
What are the things about rosé, as you said, because it can be very dry, sweet, in between, it also has the color shift, too. I mean, it can be incredibly pale, almost to the white, and it can be almost red, but it isn't.
It's all about how much time the grape is actually, the juice is on the skin. That's all that really is, and that's really just up to the winemaker and what they're going for in style. You know, I like a lot of California rosés. I like a lot of French rosés. I just picked up a couple of Willamette Valley rosés that were stunning. The thing about rosés versus this idea of old world and new world wines is it changes the playing field. They just are really great just about everywhere. It seems to be a wine that it's hard to screw up.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
And that's good. And it gives you an opportunity to experience wine from California, wine from France, wine from, and then, you know, mix it up a little bit.
And the best thing about rosés is they're reasonably inexpensive. They're reasonably cheap. Okay, I'll use the word cheap. You can buy a great rosé for $9 and you can buy it from France. It's not unusual. It's just because it's still a newer market. It's still finding its footing. And there are people who are afraid of it because they think, oh, that's going to be like whites and that's going to be sweet. No, you know. The thing is, try these wines. And like anything else, the great thing about iPhones or any kind of phone you might have, take a picture of it if you had it. Keep that label. So next time you go shopping, you can buy it again or at least compare it to something else.
And I have to put in a little plug for sweet wines. Not all sweet wines are awful. You know, they're not syrup. It's just what you use them for. I mean, if you're going to drink a big glass of it, yeah, it might kind of gag you a little bit. But the idea is that you're sipping these.
Yeah, the thing about a sweet wine is I think of a dessert wine, a late harvest wine, or even a port or anything like that. Those are very specific wines that are meant to be aperitifs, that are meant to be in that style where they're, yes, they're sweet, but their body and their structure is so incredible versus something like an apricot wine or, you know, that kind
That's
of
different.
These are not in the same league, you know.
Right.
And there are some winemakers that are going to make certain wines that tend to be a little less dry. More often than not, you can look these up on either the winemaker's website or a generic website that talks about dry versus light. I've even seen some winemakers put a little scale on the back of their label or even on their website that shows how dry or how sweet they might be. And that's really helpful when you're buying wine.
One of the things I like about the rosés is you can get kind of the demi-sec, that sort of dry, middle.
Right.
And if you add that with a little effervescence, a little bubble, it's not champagne. It's not sparkling wine completely. But it's just got a little bit of lift, and it's wonderful with some cheese and some fruit.
I prefer, when I'm drinking bubbles, I love rosé. I like a great Brut. It's a great palate cleanser, and it's refreshing as could be. And as many people know, of course, you can't really call it champagne unless it's made actually in champagne. So we call it sparkling wine over here, although there are some places that have grandfathered that in. Just look on the label, and that's the one way you're going to see right away whether it's going to be a rosé or not if you can't actually see it in the bottle. But again, a great wine, and again, more often than not, dry. I love them. I love bubbles in general. In fact, I just got some from a winery the other day. It's made me very happy. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, excellent. One of the other things we were talking about before we turned on the microphones is getting wines from places that you might not think of buying wines. Or maybe you have heard that they might have something interesting, but you haven't quite taken the step to try it. So What are some countries and where are some regions that are coming up with good wine that we might not know about here?
Sure. You know, first thing is when you go shopping, never be afraid to ask the store clerk about alternative wines, meaning different countries, because they're always a wealth of knowledge. People who work at wine stores, beverage stores these days, they've got to know their stuff. When you look how far beer has gone, you can't just say, well, it's an ale or it's a this or it's a that. You have to know what you're talking about. So I love wines from South Africa. Incredible Cabernets, some amazing Cabernets. Uruguay, you can get some great Uruguay wines for $10, $15. The half the deal is simply finding these that have great prices. Greece is making some very nice wines as well. Portugal, I cannot say enough about Portugal wines. We've talked about them before, and you're talking about over 200 great varieties in that country. So it's a little harder to learn about, but in the end, who cares? Buy it. $10, $15, $20. I just ran into one recently that was half price. It was an incredible wine. I just stocked up on it as quick as I could. Australia's still down there. People forget about it. It had its big boom back in the, you know, in the turn of the century, and people seem to forget about it, but they're making incredible wines. They're Sauvignon Blancs and New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs.
I was going to say, New Zealand has got some really good stuff coming out,
right, too. And yeah. I think people forgot about Australia. It's like, don't. You know, there's a label called Jacob's Creek, which was one I sort of started on before I got into fine wine. I think we're buying it for $15. They're still consistently making great wine. And, of course, Chile and Argentina. These are commonly known countries, but don't be afraid when you go in the store to look for those oddball sections. Spanish wines, another one. Amazing wines come from Spain. And again, very reasonably priced.
Right. And I have to put in a plug for other than Rioja. Rioja grapes are wonderful, and Rioja is a terrific red from Spain, but there are other varietals that are as good or better.
The difference is you're not always going to know them. It's not a Cabernet. It's not a Pinot Noir. It's not a Malbec. It's that thing when you try these. And the best thing about it, when you're with some friends, and if you bought something and you loved it and you start turning them onto it, now all of a sudden you're talking, hey, I've learned about some wines. You're educating yourself. A little quick side story. My sister went to a tasting recently, and she's not what I would call an aficionado. She's just kind of followed along with my niece and I in this wine trail we've all been on. And it was a local winemaker in a different state, and she was saying it was a great dinner, and the wines were just awful because they were bringing in juice from elsewhere, and it always comes down to the winemaker. And I said, well, that whole thing shows that you're at least learning. You know, it's not to judge them and say they're bad or anything, but the idea is, okay, this is not something that works with my palate. And that's how you really start learning, when you start tasting wines that aren't as appealing to you. You're maturing. You're learning.
Well, that's it. You're educating your palate.
Right. And it's that idea of not being afraid to try things.
Which I think is what we have talked about the whole time we've been having these conversations, is go try it.
And everybody's got to start somewhere. I started with a wine that few of you out there might remember, called Cannae. It was a very cheap Italian red and a white. This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. And then, yeah, I had my period with White Zinfandel. Then you start realizing, oh, maybe I don't really like that. I want to try something different. Then I became a Cabernet freak. And since then, I've tried everything I can get my hands on. There literally is no wine I dislike.
Well, I can think of one or two.
Okay, what are those?
I'm not a big Retsina fan.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, it's... You know, the pine and the reds, it's just kind of like, it's too much for me. But there's, beyond that, I have to say I'm okay.
It's this idea, though, too, of, you know, if you try it from one region, you go to a different region. Again, I'm going to go back to Sauvignon Blanc. California Sauvignon Blanc is so completely different from what you'd find in New Zealand. Completely different style, completely different flavors. What's nice in this market, because of a couple of wine stores that have opened up recently, I'm seeing more Sauvignon Blanc on the shelves, which is great, because that's every bit right up there with rosé for me. I absolutely love Sauvignon Blanc.
And it goes with so much.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Have it with scallops one day. It'll make you crazy.
I was going to say it'll make your world.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Ray Pfister, it is always great to talk with you. You're off
next week
soon,
next week I'll be in Napa and Sonoma, but it'll be primarily for the Sonoma Barrel Auction. It'll be our first trip to that, and really looking forward to it.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to talking to you about that when you get back.
Cheers.
Ray Pfister is the co-creator and voice of the wine blog and podcast, Life Between the Vines. Pfister is also the owner and engineer of Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, and he's a regular Lake Effect contributor.
We will take one last break and then chat with some folks from In Tandem Theater as they get ready to open their production of Carnival. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues right here on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. American composer and songwriter Bob Merrill is probably best known for the Barbra Streisand mega hit Funny Girl, which opened on Broadway in 1964. But before that, in 1961, he debuted Carnival.
Based on an earlier film starring Leslie Caron, the show ran over 700 performances on Broadway before it closed in 1963. Some of its songs include Rum Tiki Tiki Tum Tum, Always Always You, and Love Makes the World Go Round.
Now Milwaukee audiences have a chance to hear those songs and more as In Tandem Theater prepares to open their version of Carnival this Friday evening. The show begins the minute you walk in as the lobby has been transformed into a carnival midway.
We had the chance to sit down with actors Stephen Kaler, Keegan Siepkin, and Nathan Marinen, along with music director Josh Robinson and director Jane Fleer last week. Fleer says that even though the original Broadway production of Carnival was a critical success and it sold well, it didn't become a household name.
They never did make a movie out of it, which was surprising. When you have that many performances, usually MGM right away wants to grab it and make a movie out of it, but they didn't. They had made a movie before this called Lily, which starred Leslie Caron.
And that was a while back, though. That was in the 50s,
That was like 51. Yeah. And then they changed it up and made it into a musical, and that went to Broadway. But then a movie was never made of it. So there's an original soundtrack, but nothing else since then. So it was very much an ephemeral moment of theater. So it was a golden age, but it wasn't typical of your Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff of the day. It's got a little darkness to it. It's got some really beautiful moments to it. It's got some funny, typical musical comedy kind of moments to it. But then it's got some real heart and real depth, and that's what really attracts me to this.
Oh, yeah, the story, and I'm going to bring you guys in on this. The story is not necessarily, I mean, there's fun parts of it, but there's some really, really dark stuff. I mean, everything from cheating to abuse to, you know, all kinds of things that are going on set in this carnival setting, which is supposed to be happy and carefree.
And so what happens when you go to the carnival, it's illusion and grandeur. And then if you went backstage, if you went and pulled that curtain back, you're going to see how the sausage is made. My apologies to sausage makers.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you're going to see some stuff that's not always pretty. But it's more, to me, a story of living and learning and growing and going past certain things, getting to certain points. It takes place in the early 1920s in France, outside of Paris. And so it's, you know, we're thinking 3, 4, maybe 5 years past World War I, which was a pretty devastating war for France. And the ravages of war are going to have their effect on people and where they are in their lives, these folks included.
And you are a war vet, right?
Yeah.
Your character?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, he's a vet. He was a dancer before the war and now cannot be the dancer, and that is the source of most of his anguish and anger at the world. So it's it's wrestling with who are you once your identity is gone, the identity that you spent your whole life building. And that's sort of what we spend the whole play unraveling.
Right. Basically taken away from you in a moment.
Yeah. Just blink of an eye and your life is gone.
Yeah.
The life you knew anyway.
Here.
Yeah.
And so tell me a little bit more about your character. You're the puppeteer, is that right?
Yeah.
In the carnival.
Yeah, I'm the puppeteer in the carnival. We've had to fill in some backstory for our own sakes. We're assuming that Jaco brought Paul in after the war when Paul had nowhere to go because he couldn't go back to dancing, and dancing was all he knew. So there was a job, he took it, and he maybe tried to apply some creativity to it at the beginning and some heart and soul, but by the time the play starts, by the time we get into this play, it's just hollow and boring because it's not dance, and dance is what he wants to really be doing. And so it's become just a day job that sucks his soul.
Yeah. I was going to say the bitterness has kind of taken over.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like Paul's version of, no offense to people who enjoy their office jobs, but it's Paul's version of a cubicle.
That's not his passion.
Yeah.
And he needs to find a new passion. You know, puppeteering, it's a creative field, and it would certainly be better than any number of jobs that might be available to somebody after World War I. And it might have started out better, but like Keegan said, by the time the play starts, his passion just doesn't lie there, and he doesn't know how to move forward. He's so stuck with wanting things to be the way they were. He just can't move forward and find that new passion.
We would probably say he was depressed.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if that depression leads to just outbursts at everyone that he knows.
Depending on me to bear its burden, clothe and feed it, practically carry it, a grown-up girl with the mind of a child. Depending on me, measuring me, staring at me, measuring me. Everywhere I look, I can see her face. I can see her face, see it everywhere. And when I close my eyes, it stays. And like a leaf whirls on the wind, around my mind it plays. To be torn and tormented by one face, till the burning pain drives you so insane. You wish that you could smash that face.
And you are... your character is?
Yes, Jocko. I'm Paul's right-hand man. Jocko is grown up in the carnival. That's where he got his start. He remembers it pre-war. It's beautiful glory days. And while it's a cubicle for Paul, like, Jocko just revels in that. And post-war, with the depression and the devastation and kind of the carnival struggling to come back, he's just very effervescent and hopeful in trying to, you know, entice Paul, excite Paul. I think there's some inspiration that Jocko, who's most likely a jack of all trades but a master of none, he sees this raw talent in Paul that I think he needs to latch on to bring back his idea of success in this carnival, and they make a nice team.
Do you find his effervescence annoying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's nothing worse than effervescence when you're depressed.
Right. Yeah, all you want is just like, just go away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Then Lily comes to the carnival, mm-hmm. and she brings light and love to a place that didn't have it. I think it throws Paul for a loop.
Yeah.
Trying to wrap his head around that, but in the meantime, there's no doubt that she brings the puppets to life and makes them an act that wasn't there before.
Right. Well, she brings life to everybody, including you.
Kind of. Sort of. Yes.
Yeah. She's. I don't know what she is to me. I mean, she's beautiful and she's inspiring, and she. I think she's my future, and I always kind of hedge my bets and, you know, cover my backside as far as my professional career and my romantic life goes. But yeah, her freshness and honesty and her beauty and her talent and the way everybody, like, you know, lights up when she's around, it like makes the wheels turn for me and kind of changes the way I'm planning out my triumphs.
What's his backstory that you came up with?
Well, I mean, he's the star of the show. I don't think he fought in the war. I think he was too old. You know, he just takes advantage of every opportunity that's provided and makes the most out of it. And he's had a lot of success, and he's very proud of himself and thinks he should be, you know, acknowledged more than he is. But he really does have some insecurities and I think that's where the womanizing stuff comes from.
It was eyes you. Though my eyes may wander to and fro and yonder, still my heart's affection always beats in one direction. Every beat for you, my sweet, all the love my beating heart can brew. It shocks me so, you didn't know that it was always you.
And he dreams of playing where he feels he deserves to play. He, you know, the carnival's fine, but he feels he should be playing the legit houses of Europe.
So for you, as the you're the music director.
Yes.
Yeah. What is it like delving into this score?
Oh, the score is amazing. Going back to what we were talking about earlier about the different varieties, right? We have the puppet songs, and those are cute and fun and lighthearted. And then we have some of these soaring numbers with these melodic lines, like Always, Always You, Her Face, that kind of thing. And there's a couple of really metrically hard pieces, Sword and a Rose and a Cape. The time signature changes almost every bar, if not we're in seven and then we're in five, and that in and of itself throws a little off kilterness, you know, and gives a little bit of suaveness to Marco, who sings it, you know.
Yeah, try dancing to it.
Yeah, right.
Where's the downbeat?
Where on earth are we?
How do you dance in seven? I don't know.
Yeah, there's seven and there's five and then there's four and two and yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And I just have to say, you know, kudos to the cast. We have some marvelous voices in this cast, and it's been a pleasure. It's made my job really easy to come in, and they've done a lot of hard work getting things prepared and getting things ready to open here.
How big a band are you going to have? Is it just you?
No, we're going to have me on keyboard. We're going to have a percussionist, a flautist / doubler, so mm-hmm. He plays all kinds of woodwind instruments, and then we have a violin player.
For the waltzes.
Yes.
A former student of mine.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Really?
Brad Hartney, and I teach with him now at the High School of the Arts.
How fun.
Yeah.
So, Jane, we're sitting in a rehearsal room right now because things are happening on stage that are tech-oriented, but how are you bringing the carnival to life on your not gargantuan stage?
Well, the first thing we did is reconfigure the theater seating. When we moved into this building over 10 years ago now, we designed the seats so that they could be taken apart and rearranged, and then we just never ended up doing it, and pretty much had two-sided seating for the vast majority of our shows. So we thought, well, we need more floor space to accommodate the big dancers, big dance numbers. We have an ensemble of eight, four men and four women, so that Carl Miller, our choreographer, could have these production numbers. But without more floor space, it would have been pretty limited movement. So we took out the first four rows of our main section and those risers and moved them over to what is essentially our backstage area. So now, three-sided, we have 30-ish seats on three sides. And the fourth side, which is much smaller, is where the band is going to go.
Okay, so it's in the round, pretty much.
Pretty much. That's how I've directed it, kind of in the round, yeah.
Yeah. How fun.
Yeah, different.
I remember, of course, I think I interviewed you guys when you moved in here 10 years ago, because I've been here that long. And it's interesting to think you have not taken advantage of it until
now.
We just didn't need to.
And I was like, so we scheduled like eight volunteers, eight strong, beefy guy volunteers, and 4 hours to do it. And we were done like in an hour. And most of them didn't lift a thing. It's like, sorry, thanks for coming.
Just slid around in it.
Well, it had been designed to, and it worked. We just hadn't ever tried it. So,
fantastic.
We were pleased with that. So it's real fun because it really brings everything even in closer. And then we did another thing that we've never done before. To make it a more immersive experience, we transformed or are transforming the hallway and the lobby into a midway of sorts. So when you get there, I'll have a little costume thing on, and down the hallway, at the end of the hallway, there's going to be a Wheel of Fortune you can spin and win penny candy or maybe a drink at the bar. Then when you go into the lobby, there's a cutout of the strong man and the trapeze artist, and you can stick your face through and get your picture taken, and we'll have our live piano music like we usually do. Then there is tarot readings every night. We have a lady who does tarot readings. It'll all be for free for tips. And she's got a French deck, so she's going to be doing that. And we've got some popcorn you can take into the theater so that you just get that feel. Just, you know, start losing yourself in the world of the carnival. So when you go into the theater, you're really kind of going under the tent.
Into the space.
Right. Really. Even though, I mean, there are a lot of scenes that take place outside, but, you know, now you're going into the playing space. But I feel like the audience is walking into the theater, which is the big top, but then we have moments where we're pulling back that curtain and you get to see what's going on behind the scenes.
Now, had you guys known this musical before? No. You started. So what do you think?
I think I told Josh that when I heard the soundtrack, the Broadway soundtrack, I'm going, I didn't get it. A couple of the songs that I sing, there's parts where I'm just like, listening to it, I'm going, I don't get it. And then in the context, singing it, it's like, no, it really, I was like, wow, I don't dislike this at all. I thought I would, you know, I didn't really like it. The music didn't really speak to me until I was singing it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never had that experience before where I've heard it.
The music of this show really helps propel the storyline. A lot of musicals, you'll have some songs that help carry the the story through, and then others that are, you know,
showpieces.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I find so much of the music in this to be as compelling as the dialogue. And then the scenes themselves, none of them are very long.
Well, I know you have rehearsal and all of that stuff to get back to, but I want to thank you all so much for taking some time to sing for me and to talk and break a leg.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Jane Fleer is the co-founder of In Tandem Theater. She also directs their upcoming production of Carnival. It opens this Friday and runs through May 14th. We also spoke with actors Stephen Kaler, Keegan Siepkin, and Nathan Marinen, along with music director Josh Robinson. There is more information about the production at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and each weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.